Human beings have lived through difficult circumstances, and I think we always will. I think that's part and parcel of the human condition. But in every journey that we see through humanity, there are difficulties, there are challenges, there are joyful parts, there is pain, there is all of this plethora of emotion that we live through. And some of them are really hard. But just as much as there are also challenges, there is also a sense of community, there is joy, there is abundance, there is all of these amazing things, human beings, relationships, all of the good stuff. What I implore people to do is to genuinely take a look at their life, not the lives you see on social media, not the lives you see outside of your network, not the lives you see when you open your eyes every morning, but your life. And think about the things that are available and open to you as a human. We run a mental health charity. Therapy is not the only intervention. Sense of community, a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging. All of these things that help to bring a sense of joy to us as human beings. So that's what I would ask people to do.
Hi, and welcome back to the Business of Healthcare podcast. I'm your host, Tara Humphrey. I run an award-winning healthcare consultancy specialising in supporting primary care networks. I'm a facilitator. I am a mum of three. I have an MBA, and I would class myself as a bit of an adventurer. And I absolutely love all things business, all things leadership, all things management. So I created this podcast for clinical and non-clinical colleagues working in the field of health and care, and for those of you looking to develop your leadership skills. Every week we release an episode which focuses on the hard and soft skills required to lead in this increasingly complex environment as we move to delivering more integrated care. So let's jump into this week's episode. Hey, Danielle, thank you so much for joining me today on the Business of Healthcare podcast. How are you doing?
I'm really well, thank you very much. How are you?
I'm good. We were just saying before we press record, you saw me in a station, but you've never really met, but I feel like you're my friend.
I feel like you are my friend, and I've been following you on social media for so long. And actually, we did meet at the Precious Awards. We were sitting at the same table, and I didn't speak to you at all. I only recognised you after, because obviously we had the information in the leaflet. Then I started to see you on social media, started following you. Then we obviously had this virtual best friendship. We were messaging each other. And then, yes, I saw you in King's Cross Station and kind of came over and said, hi, this is me in real life.
I watch your videos and I was always like, she must have a filter. And then I saw you in real life and I was like, that is her skin. She doesn't have a filter.
That is so nice of you. Yes, you know, you did say that, didn't you? I've been blessed with good skin. What can I say?
So you are the former CEO of ABC Life Support. You were the interim CEO of Black Minds Matter UK. And I feel like you're going to hate me saying this. You are also the host of the podcast, It Is What It Is.
Yes, that's a lot of things, isn't it?
And what does your home life look like?
I have two teenagers. One's just about to sit his GCSEs. So one 15, one 14. I have a husband of 10 years, together for 18. And I am the homeowner of a 350-year-old Georgian pile that's been renovating for the past 10 years.
Where are you in that journey? Do you have a toilet?
Do you know what? For the first 6 years of our life in that house, I didn't have a kitchen. Just put that out there, right? I had a 5-year-old and a 6-year-old and no kitchen. When we first moved into the house, there was no bathroom. It was cubicles because it had been used as an office. I'm really pleased to now say that we do have a beautiful kitchen. We have multiple bathrooms. All is good in the world.
Wow. Well, I'm hearing resilience there. Redid our kitchen and I thought we're going to get a divorce.
Do you know what? So many people said to me, Danielle, I couldn't do this. I don't really know how we've managed it, but we did. I remember taking the children up to a local health club for showers because we didn't have anything at home. Bowls and water, which was something I was used to growing up in a West Indian household, right? Having a bowl and water was quite normal in our house. So kind of adopting that with my kids was quite normal. But we're getting there. We are getting there.
Cool. So could you share what is the vision and mission for Black Minds Matter?
Black Minds Matter UK is a phenomenal charity that was founded in 2020 after the killing of George Floyd and in the midst of the pandemic. which, as we know, affected everybody, but disproportionately affected Black people in terms of those who died, those who were on the front line, those who were working. The idea behind it was founded by two amazing women with this idea to raise funds, I guess, for culturally appropriate therapy. And they raised an obscene amount of money quite quickly, which was phenomenal. And then that startup phase, you know, lots and lots of people loved the idea and it was really well received and still is. I think now it's settled after 3 years into a very needed service for our community. The dream that I have for it is to make sure that it becomes solid and stable and sustainable to people who need the therapy that it can provide.
What do you say, and you would have seen this, but everybody's minds matter.
Oh yeah, I love that one. And everybody's minds do matter. Unfortunately, we live in a country where that sentiment isn't in practice. And it's not in practice because of all of the things that people find difficult to talk about. Systemic and institutionalized racism, opportunities for people of color, which mean then that often services or provisions for people of color or people who sit on that diverse spectrum are not taken at the forefront of services. And therefore, that's why BMM UK exists. What I find fascinating about this type of rhetoric is all lives matter, which it was in the BLM movement, and all minds matter in this movement. And to be honest with you, Tara, I tend not to get involved in those conversations because they're just a waste of time. I've got a job to do for my community. And that's what I'm kind of focused on. I refuse to be drawn into those dialogues and arguments with people where this service isn't even for them.
So what is your job?
So as chief executive, my job is to provide support for the team as we grow, to develop the therapy side of the organisation, to oversee fundraising activities, to make sure that therapists are looked after and that they are involved in the journey that BMM UK is taking. It involves making sure that there is enough money and sustainability across the charity. My job is to go out there and champion the cause and make sure that I'm showing up in spaces where conversations and impactful conversations are taking place. One of my favourite things to do, I guess, is to talk on advocacy for the role or why we need the service that we need. And that involves me talking to decision makers. And that's what I like to talk about. Or that's where I like to kind of sit, I guess, in terms of speaking to people who have power to make sure that this kind of intervention becomes part of the status quo in this country. That's my vision, I guess, long term.
What decisions have been made in your tenure that has made a real impact?
The decisions that we've made, or that I've made, I guess, is to make sure that we become fully sustainable within the community to which it serves. And that's really tough because charities are almost seen as those organisations that go to others for help and support, right? So you put out grant and trust applications or you ask big corporates for money for support. We have to be really careful with the work that we do because the charity is set to serve Black people within the UK of African, Caribbean and South American heritage. Then what has to happen is that we serve those people from our own community. Because if we don't, and we go to large corporate organisations asking for money that is mostly given by people who are not part of that community, then there is a challenge there where we have to be answerable to that. So I am working hard to make sure that BMM UK shows up for the Black community, that is helped and supported by the Black community. And I think that for me is really important. And I think actually stamping that on everything we do has been one of the biggest things that I have worked on this year, this past year.
This may be a stupid question, but I'm going to be brave. Could your service ever be funded by the NHS?
Good question. Do you know what? I think eventually every charity, I think, needs to get into a position where it's no longer needed. That's the kind of aim, right? Because you pick up an area of need. You work hard on that area of need, but especially in this particular sector or this particular field, we already have an NHS system that provides therapy to the public. But what it doesn't do very well is to take into consideration the needs and the intersectional approach for people in this country. And so I've been asked a number of times, I remember Black History Month 2023, I was pulled in so many directions, it was unbelievable. A number of those directions were to NHS trusts. I remember sitting on a Zoom call and speaking about what BMM UK does, you know, how its service works. And a couple of directors on the board were on the call and said to me, Danielle, you know, this is amazing. How could we start to integrate this kind of work within our trust? And I said, you need to do the work, right? You need to understand why you don't have this service for Black people in generic mainstream mental health services. If you go through to IAPT, for example, which is improving access to psychological therapies on most NHS sites, people will access therapy that way. But what they don't get is representation. That's definitely something I'd love to see happen. But what has to happen before that happens? There has to be more Black therapists in the NHS. There has to be more Black people who are supported in positions of power within the NHS to therefore recognise that this is something that's needed within the services to even begin that journey. So we're way off. But I do genuinely believe, especially if I can get myself into those positions of explaining what it is that's needed, we will see that change. I'm really hopeful that we'll see that change.
I've had a podcast before and we were talking about pride. It's sometimes quite hard to have these conversations on a public platform. And I'm a Black woman. It's hard because you don't want to say the wrong thing or you don't want to ask stupid questions. But I think it is important. And I think the question that I'm nervous to ask is, or the statement is, yes, we do need more healthcare professionals across the board that are ethnically diverse. We need that. And we do need more Black therapists. And we also need people that are not from a diverse background to be able to support people that are not like themselves.
Right. So this is fascinating. And I'm really glad you brought it up, right? So I've spoken about my own journey in therapy a number of times. It's not something I shy away from. It's definitely something I like to talk about. I think it's important because then people will understand that mental health challenges do not discriminate in race, in age, in gender, in sexuality, in whatever, however you show up as a human. And I've had therapy before. I remember in 2020, I developed a health anxiety, some serious challenges over health anxiety, like an awful lot of people did in the UK. And at the time, I reached out and got therapy. I accessed therapy via IAPT, which was fantastic. And my therapist was a white guy who was younger than me and amazing. You know, he was absolutely fantastic because it was a very specific thing that I needed help with. What I had was CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which again was brilliant. It's all about reframing your thoughts, which then affect your behavior, which then affect your outcomes. He didn't need to be a Black guy. He didn't need to be a Black woman. He just needed to know what he was doing and do it well, which he did. And therefore, I then got on the road to recovery. So you're bang on. But what I think isn't available is that level of micro information that talks about modalities within therapy. So therefore, people are armed and empowered with information that they can then apply in their own advocacy for their own healthcare journey. And that's what I think is super important. So you're absolutely right. It does not necessarily mean that every person of every characteristic needs somebody that matches their own characteristic in their therapeutic journey. It doesn't mean that. But it does mean that when we are having conversations, for example, my parents came over. They came over here very, very young. Their parents were of the Windrush generation. There is obviously traumas, and we know that there is trauma from that generation specifically, where if that person was going to seek therapy, the therapist that they speak to should have an understanding of a lived experience to be able to create a sense of trust and understanding in that journey. But if we are going to understand our own needs and our own journeys, especially in therapy, we need to understand the nuances that sit within it. So yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. You don't always necessarily have to have somebody of your characteristic in order to be a good therapist.
The Business of Healthcare podcast is brought to you proudly in partnership with 10,000 Donors and their Gob for Good campaign. Gob for Good is all about getting as many people as possible to join the stem cell registry. Only 3% of the UK are registered to be stem cell donors and only 0.4% of the global population. If you or a loved one have the devastating news that you have been diagnosed with a blood cancer, the chances of you finding your blood stem cell match is significantly reduced if you have a minority ethnic heritage. It is really, really simple. All you need to do is click into the show notes or visit the Gob for Good website at gobforgood.com and get yourself signed up to the registry. You could one day receive that life-saving call, or one day you may need that life-saving call. Now, let's jump back into this week's episode.
In your organisation, what are you doing to attract more people into the profession? And don't get me wrong, I know it's before, you know, like it starts at school, it's the people they know, you know, like what they choose at college and when they get into university and where they go. But is there anything you guys are doing to kind of say, look, this is a fantastic profession, you'll really make a difference and we can provide a supportive environment for you?
Not yet, but you've just helped write part of our strategy, Tara. We also understand and appreciate and actually wanting to be part of developing a centre of excellence for Black therapists in the UK. Now, there are, before BMM UK came along, we know that there are Batan, we know that there are other organisations who've been doing amazing work in this field for a very, very long time, and absolutely the most amount of respect for those organisations. And also as a Black-led organisation, I think it's important that all Black-led organisations, or some of us, can come together and do good work together by building resource and capability and capacity. So who knows how that will look in the future, but it's certainly something that we want to be part of in terms of a conversation, you know, encouraging people to go into that profession if it's something that they see fit, right? I mean, my son, for example, he's 15. He doesn't really have an idea about what he wants to do. He just wants to make some money. He wants some cash, right? So he can go shopping and stuff like that. But as a person and as a character, he would be an amazing therapist. He's all of those things that, you know, teachers say. He listens, he's caring, he asks people if they're okay, he's conscientious, all of these good characteristics that would go on to make somebody who would be a great therapist. But it's about talking to those young people and showing them that there are alternatives, there are opportunities for them in the caring sector, which I don't think is being promoted very much in school as a mother of two teenagers. It's not something that they're being offered. And I always talk about, you know, the importance of encouraging young people specifically into caring professions. It's not something that's promoted at school. I remember at my children's school, we got a letter through saying that they were having a careers fair and they're having some people coming in from the most important professions in the country. And they listed them out saying solicitors, doctor, investment banker. I mean, I was like, really? I was then thinking, these children are getting these narratives that these caring professions and these human-to-human connection-based careers aren't being promoted enough. And there, perhaps, is half the problem.
My daughter's going to be doing her GCSEs, and we had a careers conversation the other day. I was like, oh, how did it go? She was like, oh, they recommended I become a personal trainer because she likes sport. And there's nothing wrong with being a personal trainer, but that was the only option. She was like, I like sport and I like keeping fit, but I want to see what else is out there. And I'm like, good.
It's because there's no focus on transferable skills, is it? It's very literal rather than thinking about the natural ability of these young people into a job that they perhaps would fit into versus their skill set. But yeah, that's a school education system.
I should have asked you this at the top of the interview. How did you get the role of CEO in this organisation? Because you already run your business. You've got ABC, Life Support. What happened? Who met you? Why did you decide to do it?
Interesting. Very, very interesting question. So I came across BMM with everybody else in the UK in the crux of the pandemic and the Black Lives Matter movement. And they were looking for some trustees. So I joined the board of trustees, which was phenomenal, met the other trustees of the organisation. And then because of the fact that BMM UK was at that time a startup, it looked very different at that time. So startup to now establishing a charity. And I think based upon my experience, when it was recognised that the charity needed some infrastructure and scaling potential, then that I was asked to look after the role in the interim. And during the interim, it was then that I kind of fell in love with the role and felt that it was something that I could probably do in my next stage of my career, hence why I'm here.
Amazing. So are there any particular initiatives you are focused on right now?
Yeah, clearing the waiting list, Tara. Last year, the waiting list was cleared. And it was an amazing moment after having an awful lot of people. I remember when they first opened the fund, 2,600 people signed up for therapy. That was cleared last year, 23, in June. And then trying to establish a format to be able to tackle the waiting list, because what we've realised is that BMM UK will always have a waiting list because it's very specific and it's attractive to people who are looking for culturally appropriate or relevant therapy. And therefore, people will always come find us. And as a result of that, it means then we have to scale. So we need more therapists. We need to make sure that we're offering different solutions for people's challenges as well, because I don't necessarily think that everybody on that waiting list necessarily, and I'm being really careful with my words here specifically, need or want 12 weeks of therapy. Sometimes people might want to be listened to and heard, signposted effectively, or just want a check-in. And again, I do add not necessarily, right? So it's trying to understand the touch points with the community that are involved with the work that BMM UK does and getting them involved and asking them what sorts of things it is that they would find useful for their mental health and their well-being. So that's where we are right now. So I think this year is certainly going to be a year of exploration and research and asking the questions, stakeholder engagement to try and understand what the community want from us outside of the 12 weeks of therapy.
Does your stakeholder involvement go beyond your community? Is there any relationship between your GP surgeries or do people find you independently?
Back in the beginning, I believe that there was a time where people were asking for third-party referrals. So a third-party referral would be from a doctor to an organisation like ours, and then you would be passed on effectively and then processed in-house and then put forward for therapy. It quickly became apparent that if that was going to be the case, then BMM and its structure would break very quickly, because if all doctors' surgeries found out about us and referred people to us, then we would become part of the statutory services effectively, which we do not have the funding for or the infrastructure for. So we had to stop with third-party referrals very quickly and then hope that people found out about us enough in the arena, the public arena, to be able to self-refer. And that's how we take referrals right now, is self-referring. And people are now referring to the waiting list, which is being serviced four times a year. And people are aware of these, being very transparent in the dates. We're being very transparent in the processes to make sure that people are aware of how long it may take and what we're going to do whilst those people are on the waiting list to make sure that they are not just left there languishing. You know, we're having constant contact, making sure that we are assessing people for crisis points, etc., referring effectively to crisis lines and working with the wider community to try and see if we can provide quicker support rather than the end goal, which for them on our waiting list will be 12 weeks of therapy.
Can you share with our listeners, I suppose, the themes that come up when people visit the NHS for an issue with their mental health and the things that people say or the feelings that people feel that lead them to you?
I don't have any specifics to bring into the conversation, but I have been privy, because again, for me in my role, it's important that I kind of touch each of the departments, like the boss on the shop floor, you know, making sure that I understand what the processes are for our stakeholders, what the processes are for our staff, etc. And I have been privy to emails that have come in, which is our main source of inquiry. And some of the stories that are being told on there are very, very difficult. So some of them are of children, of older service users who have been struggling in and out of the NHS for years and see us as this beacon of hope and this last resort, which is a lot of pressure, right? To try and help somebody who may have a diagnosis of a chronic mental illness and who is struggling with life. We see people who have had injustice within the healthcare system. So things that they would perceive as being based on racism, on homophobia, all sorts of things that they have experienced in the NHS that they then come and tell us about, and hope, therefore, that we are going to help fix that. We have had concerns with people who have used the NHS and have been treated badly. And it might be that they have been treated badly because of, like, going back to earlier on, they've been given CBT when perhaps they needed what they felt was something different, and that was all that was offered to them. Again, they feel that there is an injustice there. So there are multiple stories, I guess, that people will have about their experiences within the NHS, therefore coming to us and seeing us as something different.
You mentioned that you've had to say no to kind of third party referrals. We all kind of know, like, to be successful, actually, we need to say no more than we say yes. So we stay on mission and that we don't overextend ourselves. What else have you had to say no to keep you on mission?
Wow, all sorts of things. Because of the work that we do, we have quite a vibrant public profile. And people want to get involved in the work that is that we do. And the brand is very powerful and very strong. And I love that. But again, it comes with its downfalls, because people all see you as something that perhaps that you are not. What I mean by that is, like I said, going back to Black History Month, you know, Black History, Black Lives Matter UK. No, those two things are not the same, right? So Black History Month last year got asked to do a number of talks and panels for large corporate organisations asking us to go and do talks on Black History Month. And I had to say no. actually, when I drill down into the whys, well, why do you want us to come and do a talk? They're like, well, we've got some Black members of staff and we rethink it's really important to look after their mental health. Oh, that's good. Yeah, so do I. But why Black History Month? And they're like, oh, because we're using it as a chance to spotlight Black mental health. I said, well, so you're using Black History Month to spotlight the pain and trauma of Black people, effectively, from a mental health perspective. And she's like, oh, okay. I said, because if you think about the theme for Black History Month 23, it was salute our sisters. As a Black woman, saluting our sisters would mean then that you're going out and championing and celebrating the lives and those of people that look like me in the community. But no, instead you want to focus on the mental health of Black people. So I said no a lot. I did say no a lot in October. And I will continue to say no this October, when no doubt it happens again. If it doesn't align with your values, or if it doesn't align with what you're doing, say no and say it with conviction.
It is completely different, but I've got a fantastic, fantastic lady coming on to talk about menopause. It's different, but she was saying about Menopause Awareness Day or week. She really doesn't like it. But the whole point of an awareness day is to raise awareness. Some could say there is an opportunity there. If it takes an awareness month that they haven't really thought about and they're doing it with good intention, there could be an opportunity to raise the profile of the amazing work that you're doing.
And it's an awareness piece. You are bang on. And that is why I was extremely busy in October. Even though, I reiterate, Black History Month was about saluting our sisters, I did an awful lot of talks about the work that Black Minds Matter UK does. But I only did it to psychologically safe organisations who had prepared for this work. Now, the example I gave you earlier was for an organisation that had four Black members of staff across 400 people. Four. So therefore, what I've said to them and what I did say to them is, have you done any anti-racism work? Have you done any work in your organisation about Black lives or diverse communities beforehand? No. So for me, it was a matter of saying no, purely because it wasn't psychologically safe for us. It wasn't psychologically safe for the four members of staff that would have been on the receiving end of that training or that talk. Because if you think about it, Tara, what would have happened is, and I said this, we could have gone into your organisation, spoken to your entire team. There are four Black people on that call. If you haven't done the work, they would have felt ostracised, embarrassed.
Yeah.
They would have felt as if, why is this happening? Everybody might have had the understanding of, yeah, but all lives matter or all minds matter. That's not safe for anybody. So it's about doing due diligence and making sure that you put yourself in positions where the awareness is going to be beneficial. So I did another talk exactly the same. We did a mental health through a Black lens in Black History Month because of we understand the importance of awareness. It was brilliant. There was a lot of involvement. There was a lot of conversations. There was a lot of kind of information about how the service works and how that organisation could work with us in the future, perhaps buying what we call our Black EAP for their Black staff members, you know, of therapy specifically. So it can work and it does work. Awareness driving is super important, but it has to be done in the right environments with the right people who have the right intentions.
Outside of Black History Month, do you feel a sense of responsibility as a female Black CEO to share your journey and be visible?
I love your questions because they are all things that I think about all the time. And the sense of responsibility that I think is sometimes held in those positions can be crippling, actually. They can be really difficult to reconcile. You know, I have had this discussion offline before. You know, the sense of responsibility that I have for me in my life is just, right? But the sense of responsibility that I have for other people, there is a little bit of me that kind of pushes against that and says, well, actually, I've got an awful lot of responsibility in my own life. I'm not kind of this beacon of thing for everybody to look up. Do you know what I mean? That's not kind of the positions I hold.
But you do.
But yeah, exactly.
You do hold it.
Only because, and again, I think a lot of it is, you know, that ego thing, isn't it? I've ended up where I've ended up because of my journey in life and because of my journey in my career. I didn't ever set out and go, right, that's what I want to do. This is where I'm going to end up. It just has happened naturally and organically. And so therefore, the responsibility has happened naturally and organically. If it happens like that, you have to do a little bit more work around accepting of that versus, well, I knew this was going to happen because this was part of my journey. That's definitely something I have taken into consideration, I think.
We haven't got time to dig into this. Did you fall into the role of CEO?
No, I didn't fall into the role. You got me there. I didn't fall into the role of CEO. But again, you know, I'm 45 this year. This isn't something that has just landed on my feet. My whole life has been what I believe in preparation for this.
Exactly. And that's what people want to hear. People want to know, okay, you may not have said when you were a kid, I want to be the CEO. I've got a daughter, Tia. She doesn't know what she wants to do, but it's really clear that she is drawn. She's mixed race. She is drawn to the Black community. So she's thinking, what do I want to be when I'm older? Move out of the way, Mum. You don't count. Move out of the way, Auntie Sue. You don't count. Move out of the way, Dad. You don't count. So she's looking. She might come across you and hear you say, it just happened naturally and organically, and this is where I am. As a young person thinking, how? What did you first do when you went to college? Have you ever made a mistake? It's just interesting. And that's what drew me to you. And I was saying, I love seeing like snippets of your day. Like, how do you spend your day? How do you spend your time? Like, you were the CEO of two organizations. How? And they were different. Very, very different. You've got a family, been in a long-term marriage. That's all very, very, very inspiring. And you look happy most of the time. But I suppose what I'm just trying to say, I understand how you may feel and you don't have to. It's just a question around the sense of responsibility. And I think we could probably point to people in our lives or in our virtual lives that kind of did something that consciously or unconsciously thought, okay, maybe if that is possible, if they did that, like maybe I could, or maybe I could try, or do you know what I mean?
I do, but then also there is an element of me that kind of wants to remove that pressure. And I think therein lies the challenge for me. You know, when I say I didn't fall into this or I didn't work for it, I genuinely didn't. And I go back to what it is that I said earlier on about transferable skills, or that people, young people, especially these days at school, are being kind of drawn to. So, for example, you talk about what I did at college. I did a health and social care diploma at college, right? School was fine. It was all right. I kind of came away with a handful of GCSEs. I went on to college. I didn't ever want to go to university. And I'm still very much in and ahhing about the whole role of long-term education and university as the only kind of output that marks success for our young people. I struggle with that, but that is a whole another podcast episode, perhaps. And I fell into health and social care because I love people. I love humans interacting with other human beings. I remember covering all ages from working in a nursery with babies right the way up to working in, you know, retirement villages and care homes for elderly people, and loving every single interaction I had with these humans. And then leaving home very young at 17, going to London, working my way through life and falling into these jobs that just sustained me because I liked people, receptionist, office management. All of these things, you know, where humans were at the forefront, and then falling into healthcare again, working at St John Ambulance and teaching people first aid. This is my life, and my life has meant that I've led here, but I never had a career goal. And that's why I said, and I do have it with conviction, that there are certain people in the world who will look at their life very clearly with a direction that they want to go in, with an aim. This is what I want to do. And all power to those people. But there are also other people who will go, do you know what? I don't know. But I do know that right now, this is what I like. And therefore, I'm going to go into that job because it gives me everything I need. And then who knows what doors will open when you are happy and you're fulfilled, which will then move on to another opportunity for you, which you can say yes or no to. And that's why I said what I said earlier, because I think it's important that people recognise, especially our young people coming up, you don't have to have it all mapped out now. Stay true to who you are. Stay true to your conviction. Stay true to what makes your soul sing. And I hope that life will open up opportunities based upon what it is that you manifest in your happiness every day.
Preach. To wrap this interview up, is there anything that you would like our listeners to know? If they were going to walk away with one thing, what would you like them to know? And I think from a healthcare professional point of view, or a potential client, or for somebody that is struggling with mental illness at the moment.
Mental illness specifically, no. I think it's far too complex to kind of mention on a, you know, a summary or conversation. But I know there is this understanding, or, you know, you've probably heard it yourself, Tara. There is no health without mental health. We talk about that all the time. And there is no health without mental health. There is no health without a holistic view of a person's life. Human beings have lived through difficult circumstances, I believe, since we recognize our place in the world. And I think we always will. I think that's part and parcel of the human condition. But in every journey that we see through humanity, there are difficulties, there are challenges, there are joyful parts, there is pain, there is all of this plethora of emotion that we live through. And some of them are really hard. It's always been the way and it will always be the way. But just as much as there are also challenges, there is also a sense of community. There is joy. There is abundance. There is all of these amazing things, human beings, relationships, all of the good stuff. What I implore people to do is to genuinely take a look at their life, not the lives you see on social media, not the lives you see outside of your network, not the lives you see when you open your eyes every morning, but your life. And think about the things that are available and open to you as a human. We run a mental health charity. Therapy is not the only intervention. Sense of community, a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging, all of these things that help to bring a sense of joy to us as human beings. So that's what I would ask people to do. And in terms of the work that we do at Black Minds Matter UK, just come along and find out a little bit more about what it is that we do. Come and see, reach out, find us on socials, come and find me, have a conversation. If everybody recognises why BMM UK exists in the first place, then everybody can recognise what we need to do to make sure that statutory services, which are available to everybody, incorporate some of the work that we do to make everyone's lives a little bit easier.
Where is the best place to go if they want to find out more?
We have quite a big following on Instagram, which is where the fund was originally kind of deployed. I'm on LinkedIn. I was about to lie there, Tara. I was about to lie. Like, look at me lying. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to say I can be found on LinkedIn. Not really. But yeah, come along, connect with me on LinkedIn and also Danielle Bridge, CEO on Instagram, if you are interested in connecting.
Well, thank you so much.
Pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. If you like what you hear, I would absolutely love it if you left us an iTunes rating and 5-star review. I know many of you give us a shout out on social media, which is lovely to see you guys listening to the podcast. So please come and find us on Twitter at THC Primary Care, on Instagram and on LinkedIn. Just look for Tara Humphrey. And if you're not subscribed to our newsletter, please do. You get to hear more insights, more confessions, some tips and tools and a roundup of our activity over the week. So click on join the newsletter in the show notes and I will see you in the next episode.